This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on February 5th, 2026.
While the new START treaty is an important first step forward, it is just one step on a longer journey.
Bad news for you, President Obama of 2010. Donald Trump has ended that journey.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA, and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As if things were not bad enough under this increasingly insane president, as of Wednesday this week at midnight, the last remaining nuclear agreement between the U.S. and Russia officially expired. A fact that, frankly, has received remarkably little news coverage up until now. We'll be joined momentarily by the longtime nuclear weapons policy analyst Stephen Schwartz, known as Atomic Analyst on the social medias, to make what sense there is to be made of that. Also, in a not dissimilar vein, we've got some nuclear energy news in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report coming up later this hour.
Yes, we do.
A lot of nuke news today.
For whatever reason, it all happened today.
A story that I've been trying to get to all week since the administration's ridiculous raid of the Fulton County Elections Warehouse last week in Atlanta, grabbing ballots and other materials from the 2020 election, and Trump's subsequent threats about nationalizing our elections or some such nonsense because he wants to pretend that he actually won the 2020 election, even though he were, 6 years later, he became president again, but he's still choking that chicken. Look, Trump may want you to pretend along with him that he won the 2020 election, and his sycophants in the administration might want to let him think that they are playing along with him. But even they know, I suspect, that he's full of crap and that his threats to take over elections would be unlawful and unconstitutional and, well, would not likely end well for his party. And that's likely just one of the reasons that three of Trump's top officials who were scheduled to speak last week to the bipartisan National Association of Secretaries of State chickened out instead of actually facing actual election officials who are familiar with actual election laws and know how actual elections run. As Paul Blumenthal reported over at HuffPost, three top officials in President Trump's administration failed to show up at the annual conference of state election officials last week after making a splashy announcement that they would confront a crowd of top state election officials. The National Association of Secretaries of State, or NASS, altered its conference schedule on Thursday to allow Attorney General Pam Bondi, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard to speak Friday afternoon. They changed their schedule for this. But by midday Friday, reports Blumenthal, this announcement dwindled to just Gabbard. The entire Trump administration appearance was then canceled just as it was supposed to start. None of the agencies nor the White House responded to a request for an explanation for the appearance or the cancellation. Maine Secretary of State Shanna Bellows, a Democrat who's running for governor in 2026, had a simple diagnosis for why they ultimately failed to show, calling them, quote, cowards. Before Bondi, Gnome, and Gabbard canceled, it looked as though they were going to appear before the officials as a show of force as the administration works to force through an unprecedented effort to seize control of the nation's elections ahead of the 2026 midterms. Well, good luck with that, kids. I don't blame you for not showing up. Frankly, with that scheme in front of the nation's top state elections officials, you know, who actually run the government, not the federal government. Bondi's Department of Justice has sued 23 states and Washington, D.C., including GOP-run Georgia, in order to obtain sensitive private voter information like Social Security numbers, driver's license, ID numbers. The cases against several of those states, including California and Oregon and Georgia, have already been tossed out by federal judges. While the department has not explained why it needs this data, states complying with the data requests are feeding into a database controlled by Gnome's Department of Homeland Security that purports to identify non-citizens, but it produces often a whole bunch of false positives. And it has already, as we've previously reported, failed to find more than a handful, and I mean a literal handful of non-citizens on any state voting rolls. And in most cases, these people had been accidentally registered and never actually voted. There has been zero evidence of the mass voter fraud by non-citizens that Trump has blamed for his loss to Joe Biden back in 2020. Bondi has tried to coerce Minnesota to release the data by demanding that data in exchange for a reduction in the immigration operation going on there, one that has already left two citizens dead at the hands of her federal officers. So they are cowards. Give me your voting data and nobody gets hurt, basically, is what Bondi is saying. And then when they need to show up and explain that crap to the people that they are suing in court and losing to, the judge in California found the effort, quote, unprecedented and illegal. Well, they're too afraid and too cowardly to actually do so. Just to give you an idea of what is going on. And the secretaries of state were laughing at them for that. So, yeah, they can, threaten to take over elections. They can threaten to put ICE officials out on the street. But frankly, on election day, and while I take that very seriously, it's also a threat that I think we will find all sorts of ways to overcome if he actually pulls that trigger. America does not like this garbage. And that is, including more and more Trump supporters every day, frankly. If you were to try something like that, I think the blowback against him and his party, I think it would end up hurting them more than helping them. But we will see. But I just wanted to mention that they're afraid to show up to make this argument to actual election officials. They're afraid of them. Let's not be afraid of them in turn. For the moment, however, in an arguably even darker turn of events today, the last remaining nuclear arms pact between Russia and the United States has now expired overnight as of midnight on Wednesday night, removing any and all caps on the two largest atomic arsenals in the world for the first time in more than half a century. The new START agreement, which expired at midnight, followed a long succession of U.S.-Russian nuclear arms reduction pacts, starting with SALT I back in 1972, signed by U.S. President Richard Nixon and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev, the first attempt to limit their arsenals. The 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty restricted the country's missile defense systems until George W. Bush took the U.S. out of that pact in 2001, despite Moscow's warnings at the time. Also terminated in 2019 during Donald Trump's first term was the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was signed in 1987, and it banned land-based missiles within a range of about 300 to 3,500 miles. Those missiles were seen as particularly destabilizing because of the short flight time to their targets, leaving only minutes to decide on a retaliatory strike and increasing the threat of a nuclear war on a false warning. That treaty now also gone. The termination of the New START treaty, the last existing nuclear agreement between the world's two largest nuclear powers, sets the stage for what many fear could be an unconstrained nuclear arms race, because I know y'all didn't have nearly enough to worry about lately. Russian President Vladimir Putin declared readiness to stick to the treaty's limits for another year if Washington followed suit, but President Trump has been noncommittal at best about extending it. He has repeatedly indicated that he would like to keep limits on nuclear weapons and involve China in arms controls, according to a White House official who was not authorized to talk publicly, if you believe such an official, but that Trump would make a decision on nuclear arms control, quote, on his own timeline, the official said. A Russia spokesperson told AP that Washington has not responded to Putin's proposed extension of the New START and that Russia, quote, will act in a balanced and responsible manner based on thorough analysis of the security situation. New START, signed in 2010 by President Barack Obama and his Russian counterpart Dmitry Medvedev, restricted each side to no more than 1,550 nuclear warheads on no more than 700 missiles and bombers deployed and ready for use. It was originally supposed to expire in 2021, but it was extended during the Biden administration for five more years. The pact envisioned sweeping on-site inspections to verify compliance, although those stopped in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and they have not resumed since. In February of 2023, Putin suspended Moscow's participation, saying that Russia could not allow U.S. inspections of its nuclear sites at a time when Washington and its NATO allies have openly declared Moscow's defeat in Ukraine as their goal. At the same time, the Kremlin emphasized it was not withdrawing from the pact altogether, pledging to respect the caps on nuclear weapons. In offering in September to abide by New START's limits for a year to buy time for both sides to negotiate a successor agreement, Putin said that the pact's expiration would be destabilizing and could fuel nuclear proliferation. In the meantime, Putin has repeatedly brandished Russia's nuclear might since sending troops into Ukraine in 2022, warning Moscow was prepared to use, quote, all means, unquote, to protect its security interests. At home, he signed a revised nuclear doctrine in 2024 that lowered the threshold for nuclear weapons use. Arms control advocates have long voiced concern about the expiration of New START, warning that it would lead to a new arms race, foment global instability, and increase the risk of nuclear conflict. Failure to agree on keeping the pact's limits will now likely encourage a bigger deployment. That, according to Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association in Washington, who said, quote, we're at the point now where the two sides could, with the expiration of this treaty, for the first time in about 35 years, increase the number of nuclear weapons that are deployed on each side. Kimball said, and this, he noted, would open up the possibility of an unconstrained, dangerous, three-way arms race, not just between the U.S. and Russia, but also involving China, which is also increasing its smaller but still deadly nuclear arsenal. So what does all of this mean, and where does all of it go from here? Well, pour yourself a cocktail, unless you're driving, because one of our favorite guests, atomic analyst Stephen Schwartz, joins us next to discuss that and more. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
It's the drink that you don't pour. Now when you take one sip, you won't need any more. You're small as a beetle, or big as a wheel. Atomic cocktail. Balls of splice all around the
I could do without that drink. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Longtime nuclear weapons policy analyst Stephen Schwartz, known as Atomic Analyst on social media, noted last night, quote, Trump has boasted for decades that he knows everything there is to know about nuclear weapons and could easily negotiate a great deal with Russia. And yet, New START, the last treaty constraining U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons, expires at midnight, and Trump hasn't lifted a tiny finger to replace it. I see what he did there. He added, quote, so what's he been busy with instead? Well, relitigating the 2020 election, unleashing the Justice Department to punish his perceived political enemies, tearing down the East Wing, taking over the Kennedy Center, kidnapping the president of Venezuela, and erecting a statue of Columbus at the White House. Well, Stephen, Columbus is not going to erect himself. Joining us now is longtime nuclear weapons policy analyst and former executive director and publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. They are, of course, the proprietors of the notorious Doomsday Clock, which, as we reported last week, was just ticked a few seconds closer to midnight. The clock's analogous moment for the destruction of all of humanity. Stephen is also the author of the book Atomic Audit, The Costs and Consequences of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Since 1940, and yes, a longtime friend now of the Bradcast. Stephen Schwartz, sir, it has been a few years, but welcome back to the Bradcast, my friend.
Thank you very much, Brad. I wish it was under better circumstances, but what are you going to do?
Well, it never is when we call on you, it seems, Stephen. As usual, I got a lot to ask you about here, as I always do. But any major points in that intro you heard me before the break that I either screwed up or left out or didn't properly emphasize as you see it?
No, the only thing I might add is that New START was originally going to expire 5 years ago today, February 1st, 2021. And throughout his entire first term in office, many people in my community, people in Congress and elsewhere, were encouraging Trump to take steps to negotiate a new nuclear arms control agreement. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, as I mentioned yesterday on Blue Sky, Trump has talked a big game for decades now about how smart he is, how much he knows about nuclear weapons, thanks in part to his brilliant uncle from MIT,
who
had nothing to do with nuclear weapons,
right,
but that's what he says. He even bragged once that he could single-handedly end the Cold War, and yet he did absolutely nothing during his first term to negotiate any kind of nuclear arms control agreement. Instead, as you noted, he got us out of, you know, a couple of them. And as a result, it was up to Joe Biden, when he became president, to invoke a clause in the treaty that was put there when it was originally negotiated to allow the treaty to be extended for another 5 years. So that was no thanks to Donald Trump at all. And now here we are again. He did absolutely nothing during his first year in office. Now we have no treaty whatsoever. I think because he, first of all, he doesn't really care about it. There's other things that he's been spending his time on. And because he views the treaty as tainted because it was negotiated by his archenemy, Barack Obama.
Right. And he could have, I mean, for all of the whining he's made about why he should, you know, receive the Nobel Peace Prize, it seems like he might have gotten a little bit closer to that had he, in fact, stepped in and made some sort of a new agreement, you know, change the name like he did with NAFTA, make a totally different, totally way better agreement with Putin. But you're right. He didn't even try. You wrote on Blue Sky on Wednesday, quote, when New START expires at midnight, nothing can legally stop the Trump regime from dramatically increasing the number of operationally deployed nuclear weapons, especially on ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and SLBMs, which are submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Within months, it could easily surge the number of such warheads by uploading MIRVs from the reserve force. I'll get to MIRVs in a moment. But all of that, Stephen, is actually true also for Vladimir Putin and Russia as well, right? I mean, if so, is that a win for the United States or for Russia or, frankly, for neither?
It's a great loss for humanity. It's not a win for anybody. And anybody who thinks that getting rid of the treaty will make the United States or the world safer hasn't living been in reality for quite some time. Mm. It's true that Russia was not completely living up to the terms of the treaty, and it is somewhat disingenuous that Putin offered to extend it for, you know, a year or so, an offer that evidently, according to one report this morning, the Trump regime was taking a serious look at, although how serious remains to be seen. The problem is here that we and Russia can both put many more nuclear warheads back on our ballistic missiles. Under the counting rules in the treaty, each side is limited, or was limited until midnight last night, to 1,550 accountable deployed strategic nuclear warheads. So under the rules of the treaty, we took many of the warheads that existed before the treaty went into effect in 2010, 2011, and we downloaded them, or we offloaded them, but we didn't dismantle most of them. We put them in storage in part to hedge against a technical problem that might, for some inconceivable reason, cause us to lose faith in the ability of these weapons to work, but also in case the world became dramatically more dangerous, we and the Russians wanted to have the option of putting those weapons back into service if we needed to. So they've been sitting in storage at great expense all of this time, being maintained for potential uploading, and now we've reached the point where that can actually happen. And the Air Force has been practicing over the years to do this, and I suspect the Navy, rather more quietly, has been doing the same thing. So we could relatively quickly, increase the number of warheads that we have. And more warheads means more opportunities for mistakes. It means more weapons that are in transit between storage facilities and operational bases. And of course, if there's ever a serious crisis and we talk about using these weapons, it means more weapons could actually be used. So it's not a win for anybody.
And more warheads, since you mentioned MIRVs in your social media post, that stands for Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicles. Very quickly, what are those? Why are those important here to like a quick buildup? And were those previously banned by the now officially expired New START Treaty?
They were not banned. There was a treaty after the original START Treaty called START II. The original START Treaty was signed in 1990 by President George H.W. Bush at the sort of the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And START II, the follow-on treaty, would have banned MIRVs entirely. So every ballistic missile that the United States and Russia had would be restricted to one warhead apiece. And
those basically allow for like several warheads in a single missile that can drop these warheads at in different places off the same rocket, essentially?
Exactly. So when ICBMs and later submarine launched ballistic missiles were originally deployed in the 1950s and 1960s, they carried, the ICBMs in particular, carried one warhead and only one warhead. That's partly because the warheads that we had at the time were exceedingly large, and we can only fit, you know, one on top of it, but also because we hadn't developed the technology to miniaturize things. But as we got better at doing that, we were able to make warheads smaller, even though they remained very, very powerful. And as a consequence, we could pack more of them on top of our missiles. So the Minuteman III missile that we have today is the Minuteman III because it used to carry three warheads. Now it only carries one. Russian missiles, you know, might have carried 8 or 10 warheads. They only carry one now. The advantage of putting multiple warheads on your missile is that you can use one missile to theoretically destroy many targets on the ground. So you don't, you know, one missile could take out perhaps, you know, 4 or 5 targets instead of just one. So the advantage is that you don't have to disarm yourself if you're going after an adversary's weapons or infrastructure or anything like that. Whereas if you only have one missile, or sorry, one warhead on a missile, you're kind of one and done. The disadvantage, though, is that those missiles with all those warheads become prime targets for your adversary, because, of course, if they can use one weapon of theirs to take out 8 or 10 of yours, that's a tremendous, you know, advantage. And so it becomes very destabilizing to put large numbers of warheads on missiles. And we've been trying to sort of put that genie back in the bottle for decades. And START II was the closest that we got. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. Then some years later, New START came along. And while we didn't go down, we didn't ban MIRVs. We said you can only put one on. And that's good. But now we could, and it's not clear that we will, but we could move very much backwards very quickly.
Well, speaking of destroying of the enemy's weapon, whoever the enemy may happen to be, I don't know. One of the reasons that maybe Donald Trump wasn't so interested in this agreement is because he's been talking about this so-called Golden Dome of his, this defensive missile shield. AP reports that the Kremlin has described the efforts to build such a shield as a major threat, as they see it, arguing it would erode Russia's nuclear deterrent by giving the U.S. the capability to shoot down its intercontinental ballistic missiles. In response, AP notes, Putin has now ordered the development of the Berevestnik nuclear-tipped missile and nuclear-powered cruise missile, and the Poseidon nuclear-armed and nuclear-powered underwater drone, which I guess prevents it from being blocked by a defensive air missile system because it's fired from underwater. Am I essentially understanding that?
Yes. The Golden Dome is the latest iteration of decades of efforts to try to use technology to eliminate the political problem that gives us the threat, the ever-present threat of nuclear war. But it only works, if it works at all, against weapons that are flying through the air, whether it's cruise missiles or ballistic missiles. It does not work on anything that would be coming at you from underwater, nor, for that matter, would it shoot down planes that happen to be carrying nuclear missiles or nuclear gravity bombs. So yes, that particular weapon, also known as Poseidon, is an effort to kind of do an end run around any kind of defense that the United States could deploy in order, at least in Russia's mind, to maintain nuclear deterrence. To say, okay, you've got this system. We don't think it works. You seem to think that it does, but it can't touch these particular weapons of ours. So you better not do anything crazy, because in our back pocket, we have these weapons that can shoot at you and you'll never know they're coming until it's too late.
Russia, in fact, said, if you believe them, that last year they successfully tested that Poseidon underwater drone missile and the Berevestnik missile, and that they are preparing to deploy them. Trump loves to talk about, you know, his plans for a Golden Dome akin to Israel's Iron Dome defensive missile system. But, I mean, would a so-called Golden Dome potentially make the U.S. more vulnerable to attack rather than less so if it leads to what Russia is talking about, you know, developing new types of systems? In response to that, Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association said that Russia and China are, quote, likely going to respond to Golden Dome by building up the number of offensive weapons that they have in order to overwhelm the system. and make sure that they can retaliate with nuclear weapons. He says that adding offensive capabilities is much faster than and cheaper than defensive ones. So does a Golden Dome actually end up making us more vulnerable rather than less so?
It absolutely could. And that's one reason why we had something called the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which was negotiated during the administration of President Richard Nixon. It went into effect in 1972, and it did a very good job of stopping a very dangerous and very expensive offensive-defensive arms race that was driven by the deployment, the rapid deployment on both sides of these multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles that we were just talking about. Both sides were very interested in the 1960s in trying to develop some kind of defensive system to protect themselves against the onslaught of an attack from the other. And we learned very quickly that, you know, the way to get around any kind of defensive system is to simply overwhelm it with more warheads, which MIRVs made much easier and much less expensive to do. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, you're in the United States and you develop a ground-based or a space-based defensive system, Russia just needs to put more warheads on its missiles or build more missiles and put more warheads on them in order to increase the number of weapons that our defensive system has to deal with, and very much vice versa for us. And so there's really no end to that. Any defensive system that you can build, it's no possible way that it can cope with an unlimited number of weapons. We don't have enough, you know, physics doesn't work that way. We don't have enough money to put enough satellites and, you know, build enough interceptors and all of that. And so wise people in the 1960s decided, and then, you know, coming into fruition in the 1970s, that we better put a stop to this. Otherwise, we could very much bankrupt ourselves if we didn't actually end up, you know, starting a nuclear war inadvertently or on purpose. And so that treaty worked very, very well. And then the Reagan administration started chipping away at it when Reagan launched his Strategic Defense Initiative program in the early to mid-1980s. And then President George W. Bush came along and, at the behest of Republicans who had hated that treaty for decades, unilaterally walked away from it. So and that was in 2001, 2002. So the only reason that Trump can even envision a Golden Dome, let alone, and obviously we've already allocated a lot of money toward it, is because there are no restrictions on those kind of defenses. But yes, if we go back to that world where both sides are scrambling to develop a defense against the other, and we can put as many warheads as we want on all of our missiles, and there's no restriction on offensive nuclear forces, not only are we shooting ourselves in the foot, so to speak, but we're making the world a much more dangerous place. So the last thing, if you're Donald Trump and you want to have a system that will protect all of the United States against any conceivable kind of attack, the last thing you would want to do, if you were smart, would be to give Russia the ability to deploy as many nuclear weapons on long-range ballistic missiles as it wanted, because that's just going to needlessly complicate the already complicated job that you're trying to do.
Well, let me press back on that, because all of that, you know, said, the New START, New START treaty now expired, but it was a cap on the number of deployed warheads. It was for the U.S. and Russia. Does it actually matter in a world now where an increasing number of nations who are not party to that treaty now have their own nuclear weapons and are pretty much unconstrained by such treaties?
Well, the number of states that have nuclear weapons has been stable for quite some time. Sure, we're worried about Iran potentially getting them, and, you know, the most recent entrance to the nuclear club, as it were, North Korea, India, and Pakistan. You know, we're certainly concerned about them, as we should be, but, you know, to throw away a treaty because it doesn't include, you know, everything is just to, you know, kind of not understand what the potential of arms control, you know, actually is. Sure, it would be great, and we should have, negotiations and discussions with China about their relatively, apparently rapidly growing nuclear arsenal. They are appear to be building large numbers of ICBMs and are taking a much more aggressive posture, but whether all of the holes in the ground that they've built will be filled with actual missiles and whether those missiles will actually be armed, remains to be seen. It's possible that it could in part be a strategic feint to lead us to believe that they are more powerful than they actually are in order to deter us from attacking them, which is a big concern of theirs. We don't know. But, you know, we still have to worry about Russia, notwithstanding Trump's, willingness to sort of grovel at Putin's feet whenever the opportunity arises. They still have, you know, a very large nuclear arsenal, if not the largest, then the second largest in the world. And to allow them to make it larger with absolutely no constraints just doesn't make any kind of, it's not rational, it doesn't make any kind of strategic sense, unless you don't really care about arms control. I mean, I think the thing you mentioned earlier, Trump and the Nobel Peace Prize, he wants the credit, he doesn't want to do the work.
Right.
And the work here is actually sitting down with your adversaries and talking about what it is that would make all of us safe, and coming to some understanding that would have to obviously be step by step, and you know, certainly could not be, you know, we can't do this overnight. We can't bomb China the way that, you know, we have bombed Iran. We can't kidnap Putin the way that we went into Venezuela. We can't do those things with nuclear armed states. We've got, you know, there are constraints on how far we can go. But you don't want to make it more complicated than it needs to be. You don't want to make it more expensive than it needs to be. It's possible, you know, something like Golden Dome could potentially work against a relatively small attack. Let's say something that, you know, North Korea could mount today. But from there, you know, we have tested the, you know, our missile defense system, our sort of pre-Golden Dome system, the system that we have now that's operational. If you saw the film The House of Dynamite on Netflix, which I, you know, highly recommend, you could see what goes wrong with a system that, you know, has limited capabilities. And that's only against one missile. If you start talking about, you know, multiple missiles with multiple warheads, very quickly it becomes impossible to stop anything. So, you know, I won't say that I've given up on the Trump regime, but I see no evidence that they are really serious about constraining nuclear weapons with anything other than, you know, verbal threats and, you know, threats to use force. They're not interested in diplomacy. They're not interested in existing agreements that have been shown to work. They simply want to do the sort of might is right and boss everybody around. You can't have nuclear weapons, but we can. Mm. And because we have them, we will keep you from getting them. That never worked. It's not going to work today.
And you mentioned both Iran and North Korea. I've got a quick question about each I want to ask you, but very quickly. Last year, Trump, rather injudiciously, it seems to me, I know that's unlike him, but he announced that the U.S. would start nuclear weapons testing again. That was pretty much the last we heard of that after he sort of blurted that out. Do we have any idea if that is actually still the plan? And is it a good one or a terrible one, Stephen Schwartz?
It's a terrible one and it's an unnecessary one. We have not tested nuclear weapons underground in Nevada since September 23rd, 1992. And the reason we haven't tested them since then is because we don't need to. We have a very well funded program that allows us to simulate nuclear weapons explosions in very fast, very expensive computers at our national weapons laboratories in New Mexico and California. And so unlike every other state that has nuclear weapons, we know with a great deal of certainty how well these weapons will work, even though we haven't physically, you know, blown one up in several decades. Mm-hmm. Other states tested, you know, we tested nuclear weapons more than We blew up nuclear weapons more than 1,100 times, more than
pretty much
every other state in the world combined. We have a unique level of knowledge about these weapons because of all of that testing, almost all of it, by the way, which was done to develop new types of weapons, not to make them safer. So every other state in the world, particularly those that are considering developing nuclear weapons, like let's say Iran, or have a small nuclear arsenal like North Korea, would love to do nuclear testing again, because they could learn far more from such tests than we ever would. Mm. So if we blow up, so to speak, the moratorium on nuclear testing that has existed since the 1990s, we have not ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, but we are a party to it, and we have so far pledged not to resume nuclear testing. But if we blow that up and say we're going to start testing again, then everybody else can start testing too. And like I said, they will get more out of that than we will, and those weapons will in turn become a threat to us and threats to our allies. So if you want to increase the danger in the world, if you want to make the world a more unstable place, then by all means start blowing things up in Nevada, which, by the way, the people in Las Vegas, you know, about 60-90 miles from the test site, and the people in Nevada generally, I don't think they're going to be very willing to do that, to allow that to happen. And we have nowhere else in the world, unless we take over some country, that we could do that kind of work.
Okay. I was going to say, how about down in Mar-a-Lago? Just a thought. Stephen, very quickly, last June at Israel's urging, I believe, Trump unleashed an attack against Iran's nuclear program. He claimed that it was annihilated at the time. He got very angry when other nations and indeed the U.S. government's own intelligence community said, no, it's not actually annihilated. We're some months past it now. Do we have a clearer picture on whether or not Iran's nuclear program, such as it ever existed, was actually annihilated, as he repeatedly and angrily insisted at the time?
Well, you can't annihilate an idea. You can disrupt, you can destroy, you can degrade. I mean, I'll pull out a thesaurus here, but you know, if a country is hell-bent on getting nuclear weapons, at the end of the day, there's not a whole lot that we can do to stop them. We can slow it down. I mean, look at North Korea, for example. I know that's not the state you were just talking about, but North Korea has been under sanctions for decades, an impoverished country, you know, not much access to high technology, and yet they have done it. And they have, it's just a small number of weapons, but they are able to deter us with that, which should tell us something about what it takes to actually keep somebody from attacking you. It doesn't mean you have to have a massive arsenal. It doesn't mean you have to have, you know, dozens of warheads on each of your missiles, or, you know, not dozens. We can put like 3 or 8 on ours, but you don't have to have lots of multiple warheads. You have to have the capability. You have to prove that you have it, and you have to show that you're willing to do it and make sure that your adversary believes it. If that's all in place, the numbers don't really matter all that much unless you're dealing with somebody that thinks they can actually, you know, literally fight a nuclear war, which I hope we're not dealing with. But no, I mean, it's, you know, Iran has certainly been set back, and I think they've got bigger problems now than trying to figure out how to move forward with their nuclear ambitions. But no, we didn't, you know, we pounded them terribly, but we did not by any means, I don't think we stopped them from doing it. That would require a far bigger attack that would be, you know, the precursor to something I don't even want to imagine.
I think between that and side by side with the way Donald Trump has treated North Korea, unfortunately, I think it does, you know, give people a good reason to develop these nuclear weapons, because it does, in fact, seem to keep them safer, at least from nations like ours. The threat of North Korea's nuclear arms has, you know, been a very big issue in recent years. But it does seem, in fact, that Trump's willingness to meet face to face with Kim Jong-un during his first term, that does seem to have cooled that threat somewhat. No?
Somewhat, but if you recall 2017, you know, fire and fury like the world has never seen,
right.
You know, until they both fell in love and exchanged love letters.
Yeah.
That was a really, really rocky time. I mean, the Secretary of Defense at the time, Jim Mattis, told people later or wrote later that, you know, he slept in his gym clothes so that at any moment in time, he would be able to get up and deal with what he imagined would be a very serious crisis involving the potential use by the United States or North Korea of nuclear weapons against the other. So, you know, he took that very, very seriously. And, you know, I think belatedly we, you know, we should too. So unfortunately, yes. I mean, I think the message is, yes, if you have these weapons, you can sort of hold, you know, your adversary at bay and you can potentially boss other countries around. But countries, you know, historically don't like to be bossed around. They enjoy their sovereignty. They want to be, you know, they want to live their own lives and do what they want to do. And if somebody comes into their neighborhood and starts telling them what they can and can't do, they typically don't really react well to that. And if you throw nuclear weapons in the mix, you know, it gets very, very unstable very quickly. I would have thought we would have learned this in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, but you know, Donald Trump famously doesn't really read, and the people around him are not willing to challenge him on the facts. And so I do worry that we are going to potentially relive some of the more dangerous parts of the Cold War, which honestly, we only got through because of luck. And luck does eventually run out.
And I'm running really late, so I got to get a quick answer from here, Stephen, because I enjoy talking to you so much on all of this stuff. But as a nuclear weapons analyst for decades now, overseeing all of this, very quickly, who do you currently see at this moment as sort of the greatest nuclear threat to the world? Is it Russia? I know that many have worried about Putin's threats to use nukes in Ukraine. Is it China? Is it the U.S.? Is someone like India, Pakistan, North Korea, or even Iran, or Israel? You know, who is the greatest threat right now to the world?
Take your pick. It really depends on the context, I suppose, but I guess I'm an American, so I worry most about the kind of things that I can, you know, the things that I can deal with that I can help change. I think I have to say that, you know, the Trump regime is gives me great pause. I think there are, you know, this is a president, and this is, you know, surrounding himself with people that are willing to debase themselves, you know, and destroy or ignore any principles they may have had to tell him what a wonderful job he is doing and to ignore reality. And when you combine that with the kind of threats and bluster that Trump likes to make and the feeling that he gets from being, you know, the all-powerful Oz, it does make me worry. There were some checks and balances in his first term in office, in the Defense Department and in Congress, where we could look at things and say, okay, this is bad, but there are people that could, you know, tell him to his face, this is unacceptable, you can't do this. Those people are gone. And the people at the bottom of the chain, the ones, the young men and women who actually turn the keys and push the buttons to actually launch these weapons once, you know, if Trump were to give an order to do so, they're not going to have any idea about his justification or his rationale, or frankly, his state of mind. They're going to follow what they believe to be is a legal order that was passed down from on high. And by the time they find out that maybe it wasn't legal, you know, it will be too late. Things can spiral out of control very, very quickly. And we got too close the first time, and I worry about us treading dangerous waters, you know, this time around, too.
Stephen Schwartz, longtime nuclear weapons policy analyst, former executive director and publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, author of Atomic Audit, The Costs and Consequences of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Since 1940, and, as I always like to say, a must follow on social media. You will find him now at Blue Sky at Atomic Analyst. Stephen, always a delight-ish speaking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Yes, thank you very much, Brad. I appreciate it. You know, there's no shortage of things to talk about, unfortunately, but perhaps the next time, maybe we'll have a little bit of good news from some corner of the world. Who knows?
I doubt it. Thank you, Stephen. Okay, let's take a quick break. We are back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report with still more nuclear news.
True.
Nuclear energy in this case. A big nuke news day, I guess, here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Okie dokie then.
A lot of nuke stuff today.
Yeah, I know. It's always great when we get to the Green News Report, and that's the lightest news of the day.
Yes.
As we find in our latest Green News Report.
The Olympics are here, but winter itself is struggling to compete.
Future Winter Olympic Games may start earlier due to warming winters. Low-income heating assistance program survives congressional budget process. Plus, the Trump Energy Department has secretly gutted nuclear plant safety rules.
Oh, fantastic. All of those explosive stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It is the 10th day in a row that we have been below freezing temperatures. And all I can say is, oh, sorry, folks, you get what you voted for. That's right. Old comrade Mamdani, been in for less than a month, and we're already Siberia.
This is your Green News Report. Well, okay, old comrade Desi Doyen, what do you have for us today?
Well, first up, as we go to air, the Winter Olympic Games are about to begin in the Italian Alps, where officials were relieved that sufficient natural snow arrived just in time after an unusually warm December. But the Games will still rely on manufactured snow, as warming temperatures and snow droughts make winter conditions increasingly unreliable. Mountain areas around the world are heating up faster than the rest of the planet due to man-made global warming, bringing shorter winters, more rain, and less snowfall.
Well, I enjoyed the Winter Olympics while they lasted.
Yep. The International Olympic Committee announced on Wednesday that it is considering earlier start dates for future Winter Olympics and the Paralympics. Studies project that by 2040, only 10 nations will be cold enough to host the Winter Games. Here's Dr. Daniel Scott in an interview with NBC News.
Under a high emission scenario, you'd lose almost two-thirds of the climate-reliable hosts.
So just 10 climate-reliable hosts, eh?
Yep. And in Japan, it's the opposite problem. The prime minister has deployed troops to assist areas that have been crippled by record-breaking snowfall over the past 2 weeks that has knocked out power and caused at least 30 deaths. Some regions have seen more than double their usual volume of snow. Here in the U.S., the Trump administration has secretly rewritten nuclear safety rules to accelerate development of new experimental nuclear reactor designs.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
According to internal documents obtained by NPR, the secret new rules slash long-standing security standards, eliminate requirements to protect groundwater from radioactive contamination, and they raise the amount of radiation that workers can be exposed to before triggering an official accident report.
Oh, man.
On Monday, the Trump Energy Department announced an effort to quickly build experimental nuclear reactors this summer, and to do that, it will exempt those new reactors from the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires federal agencies to report on the environmental impacts of new projects. Here's Edwin Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
I think that DOE's attempt to cut corners are posing a grave risk to public health, safety, and natural environment here in the United States.
Well, yeah, how can they do that? How can they just secretly change the rules? Isn't that a public procedure that has to go through public comments and so forth?
Yes, that is how it is supposed to work, but the Trump administration doesn't usually follow those rules.
That's true. They kind of make up whatever rules they want, don't they?
A bit of good news, a long-running federal program that provides energy bill assistance for Americans, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, known as LIHEAP for short, has survived another year, finally receiving funding in budget bills passed by Congress this week, despite the Trump administration's efforts to kill the program. Mm. In other news, a Dutch court ruled last week that the Netherlands violated the human rights of residents of the tiny Caribbean island of Bonaire, a Dutch territory, by failing to protect them from the effects of climate change. The Hague ordered the Netherlands government to set binding targets to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions within 18 months and issue an adaptation plan for Bonaire, which faces rising sea levels. And finally, the Federal Energy Information Administration's latest monthly electric power report once again confirms that solar is the fastest growing source of electricity in the U.S., despite the Trump administration's efforts to quash renewable energy. The EIA reports that solar, wind, and battery storage will make up 99% of new electricity capacity built in the U.S. this year.
99%?
That's what they project.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Light it up, baby! Hey!
Light it up indeed.
Yes,
thank
please.
You very much, Desiree Doyen, our producer. Thanks as well to our guest today, atomic analyst Stephen Schwartz, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or you want to share it with someone you know, love, and or hate, you can always do that for free anytime at bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider hitting one of those donate buttons, helping us celebrate our 22nd anniversary of troublemaking and muckraking over at bradblog.com, or you go straight to bradblog.com/donate to do the very same thing. Thank you in advance. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog and Desi Doyen at
Green News Report. Please come by and say hi.
We will see you all there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.